On this episode of the Global Heart Podcast, we'll be speaking with Bill Mairasola, Director of the Department of Chronic Diseases at the Institute of Clinical Effectiveness and Health Policy in Argentina. She will be talking about her paper, Implementation Outcomes and Strategies for Delivering Evidence-Based Hypertension Interventions in Lower Middle-Income Countries. This paper was published in May 2023 in PLOS ONE.
And then we will welcome Anthony Rogers from the George Institute of Global Health, University of New South Wales in Australia, who will speak on the rationale for a new low-dose triple single pill combination for the treatment of hypertension as we delve deeper into high blood pressure research.
Finally, we will hear from Tom Gassiano, Associate Professor at the Department of Health Policy and Management at Chan School of Public Health from the United States. He will be talking about his paper, Results of a Remotely Delivered Hypertension and Lipid Program in More Than 10,000 Patients Across a Diverse Healthcare Network, which was published in January 2023 in JAMA Cardiology. I'm Pablo Perel here at the World Heart Federation.
And I'm Rick Roubaix from the Global Heart Journal. All of that coming up today on the Global Heart Podcast. So, Wilma, of course, we've read your paper with interest, but maybe you can just briefly explain to us why you started this in the first place.
Well, this paper is about a consortium of implementation research working on hypertension and how to improve hypertension control globally. Back in 2016, NHLBI funded 8 grants under 2 funding opportunities. One of them were focused on capacity building for implementation research connected with hypertension control that was called HITRAIN, the HITRAIN group. And the other call was focused on conducting implementation research for hypertension control. And this is the origin of the HITREC consortium. Five different projects were funded under this call in 3 continents. They were Guatemala in Central America, Kenya and Ghana in Africa, and India and Vietnam in Asia. And this is a consortium. And the motivation to start this study was basically to take advantage of our work in the HITREC consortium to share with the research community, especially in low and middle income countries, about our real world experience, the frameworks we used, how they work, what the implementation strategies we planned to use and collaborate with mutual learning.
But in this study, I believe what you did was trying to get information about the prevalence of hypertension, as well as the awareness of that. Is that correct?
Actually, our focus was building on that information from other studies and try to find and test solutions using methods from implementation science. So, for example, 4 of these projects were cluster randomized control trials, and one of them was a quasi-experimental design to test different interventions in implementation science.
So, for example, can you give some examples of how those strategies then work?
Yes. For example, one of the projects was about testing a complex intervention, including community health workers going from primary care clinics to the community and visiting them and training them about topics related to how to reach a better control of their hypertension. And also we included other stakeholders at different levels with the same goal of putting in place strategies to improve hypertension control at the health system level.
And how did you measure the quality of control?
Well, we used implementation evaluation frameworks like RIAM, RIAM PRISM, or the Proctor's framework. All of these frameworks were used to measure implementation outcomes in these studies. For example, all the studies measure outcomes such as effectiveness, adoption, implementation, acceptability, feasibility, sustainability, using, in general, mixed methods approaches.
Vidma, one thing that I found quite interesting about the paper is, I mean, this distinction that you made about implementation strategies and interventions and all that kind of glossary of, because I think for many people, like we're coming from clinical epidemiology, maybe sometimes that is like a minefield with all these classifications and definitions. And I find it quite useful what you have in your paper. Can you make the distinction between strategies and interventions and maybe give some examples of the strategies that were evaluated in these projects?
Yes, sure. We find evidence-based intervention as those interventions, practices, policies, programs that were proven effective to make changes in different areas, in this case, hypertension. Usually these interventions are complex interventions with different components. And this is different from the implementation strategies that you design to put in place those components of the intervention. For example, you can have a complex intervention where some of its components are capacity building and training for healthcare workers, self-management or control of hypertension, text messages, and other mHealth solutions directed to hypertensive patients. So those are the components of the intervention, but this is different. This is the what I want to do. And this is different from intervention implementation strategies, which would be how I will conduct, I will put in place those components. For example, if the component is sending text messages to hypertensive patients, we can have different implementation strategies. We can send them weekly or daily or monthly according to the culture and the climate and the context. So that's the difference between the intervention with key components. This is the what I want to do, and the different implementation strategies that can work in different contexts. That is the how to do that.
So you have indeed been examining different countries, different environments, if you wish. Are there general lessons to be learned about how to implement once you have an intervention that you feel might work? Is there general principles that we can apply when examining a certain context or country?
Well, according to our learnings in this consortium, we think there are three pillars in implementation science that apply to every context. These are, first, a deep knowledge of the context where you are going to work, a meaningful stakeholder engagement and involvement from the very beginning of your project, and the co-design of implementation strategies. I say that those are the three pillars that apply to every implementation research project.
So if we want to take these lessons at heart, and we start in a certain environment, a certain country, you say deep understanding, you know, where do you get that understanding?
There are several tools to conduct contextual analysis. And I like your question, where do you look for that so key information in the community, talking with the stakeholders, with the organizations you are going to work with? Different stakeholders have different interests and levels of influence and conflicts of interest as well. So you find this information actually being in contact, genuine contact and interaction with all the stakeholders involved in the project.
And that would include patients.
Yeah, and it will include patients, their families, their friends, their social environment as well. I'd say the whole community.
Rick asked you about the implications in terms of practice and lessons learned, but I'm also interested about implications for research. Did you find certain aspects that are not being studied, like particular implementation strategies or methods that need to be further developed? Was any conclusion on your consortium of areas for and priorities for research in this area?
We were able to measure key outcomes such as reach and effectiveness, adoption, implementation, acceptability. But the most difficult implementation outcome, and I think that this is a learning and a field to explore more in depth, is sustainability. It was very difficult for us to measure sustainability of these interventions in a comprehensive way, mainly because of the timeline that we had to comply with because of our funders. So I think that planning sustainability from the very beginning of any project is key in implementation science, and we still need a lot of tools and methods to do it better.
And to what extent is financing an important element in that? Because I would think there's many things we might want to change, but economic circumstances may be rate limiting. I would assume that in many of the countries that you have been working, patients still have to pay out of pocket, for example, when it gets to drug delivery or...
Absolutely, absolutely. And for example, coming back to this consortium, we use the ERIC taxonomy to explore implementation strategies, and the least implementation strategies that were used were those connected with changing infrastructure or using financial strategies, because it is much more difficult to work at that level. So I think that including policy makers, decision makers, governments, those are key stakeholders in implementation science to be able to change things in reality.
Yeah, that was an interesting finding, I realized, Dilma, from your paper. I mean, those implementation strategies like financing and change infrastructure that are the most difficult, of course, they were the least study. But maybe you can clarify, the ERIC taxonomy, just briefly what it is for our audience.
Yes, ERIC taxonomy includes 73 implementation strategies that are grouped in 9 different domains. And 2 of those domains are changes in infrastructure and financial strategies. Those were the domains least approached by our projects.
All right. So in order to bring this field further, if you were to take one action from your position as a researcher, what would you do?
I would promote collaboration. To me, that's a key word in implementation science. Collaboration, 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 sharing learnings. That's why we try to contribute with this paper as well.
That links very nice with the question I had, and as we are wrapping it up, Vilma, is what happened with this consortium after this paper? Are you still working together, or any other group of people working on implementation research on hypertension that they want to approach any consortium or collaboration? Can you share opportunities? I'm sure in our audience would be many people working on implementation research on hypertension, and you might be willing to share some of the opportunities to collaborate.
In this consortium, we created a coordination center, which is called GRIT, and is led by Benga Ogedebe. We are all very thankful, really, to Benga for coordinating and supporting us through this coordination center, and the idea is to grow through this coordinating center and include other researchers or groups working in implementation science on hypertension. So to me, that's the future. the HITREC consortium can grow through this channel of the central coordination led by Benga.
Thanks, Wilma. I'm afraid that time is running out. This was extremely useful also for those of us who are perhaps not that at home in implementation research. I think that's very learnful and something to take on board, because it's not only knowledge, of course, that we need to generate, but we also have to have impact and results. Thank you very much for being with us.
I have one final question, Wilma, I mean, for all our interviews. As you know, we are starting this podcast on global cardiovascular research. And I think those that we work on this area, we believe that we do it, but when you try to find a definition of this concept, it's quite elusive. So I just want, in one sentence, or just very briefly, what you understand by global cardiovascular research.
I think that global cardiovascular research can be seen from many different perspectives. From the standpoint of implementation science, to me, it's key to advance our knowledge and practice to find effective and feasible solutions that contribute to improve cardiovascular health globally.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. It was really a pleasure having you here. I think we've learned a lot. Also, for those of us who are not perhaps so familiar with implementation research, and keep up the good work, and see you next time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. My pleasure and honor.
Thank you, Wilma. Thank you, Anthony, for joining today. We're very happy to have you here in the podcast. We want to hear more about the paper that you published in Global Heart about the rationale for a new low-dose triple single pill combination for the treatment of hypertension. Can you tell us a little bit about why you started this program and what it's about?
Yeah, thanks, Pablo. It's a pleasure to join. And really, the rationale is very simple. It was to aim to develop an affordable, radically more effective way to treat high blood pressure. So as you may know, there's been a few international trials suggesting you get a really large improvement in blood pressure control rates with these hypertension polypills, but there's none yet on the market. And so we wanted to address that need.
I mean, hypertension is arguably one of the most studied conditions in medicine. And we have a huge armamentarium of medication. Why do we need to have new trials on hypertension?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It is somewhat unusual in that there are perhaps more products for hypertension than any other product. But unfortunately, there's a very large range of low to moderate efficacy products. And what we and others have found is that you get much better hypertension control rates if you start treatment with something that's high efficacy, which means, you know, 15 to 20 millimeters of systolic blood pressure straight off. And that gets blood pressure control at high levels, 80% or so immediately. And so reduces the chances for treatment inertia and just gets control quickly.
In the paper, you present, let's say, a program. By the way, how do I pronounce the GMR2? What's the right?
Yeah, it's GMRX2, which stands for George Medicines, and then RX2 is the second product. But I'm sure it'll have a different name by the time it reaches the market.
Okay, so tell us about the program. I know it's a suite, a portfolio of different studies. So can you summarize what are the main studies?
It's an international program, but the primary audience, if you like, is the FDA. We want to submit to the FDA next year. And with that approval, then go to other regulatory authorities, maybe in parallel. And the key things that a regulator needs to see to approve a hypertension polypill is first off what they call the combination rule. You have to prove that each component makes a useful contribution to the combination. So we've got a trial of the triple versus all the duals. And also you need to show the full efficacy and side effects. So there's a trial against placebo, a short-term trial against placebo.
Also, in the paper, you mentioned two other trials, one in Africa, the Veronica trial, and the Trident.
That's right. And we're very excited about those trials. Those are grant-funded trials that are going to read out in the next year or two. And Veronica working with DKOJ and other collaborators in Abuja, Nigeria, that's comparing this strategy against the Nigerian hypertension guidelines, with looking at whether it improves blood pressure control and tolerability longer term. And the Trident trial is a large cardiovascular endpoint trial led by Craig Anderson and a team of many other experts in the stroke area, looking at whether the addition of GMRX2 to existing care will reduce recurrent stroke.
Anthony, this is a polypill strategy, huh? And in a way, you've been in that field for a long time promoting polypills. Mm. I'm just wondering, why not have a statin included too in this drug? Would that not make sense?
Love to. Yep. I think that should be on the shopping list straight away. Yeah.
Is there a particular reason why not now?
Yeah. So one hard lesson we've learned in this area is formulation is surprisingly challenging. Many very competent companies have tried and failed to get formulations together that are bioequivalent and stable and still have low cost of goods. And so we kind of picked a kickable goal, if you like. And I think that's another lesson from a successful company in the area, Ferrer, and their partnership with CNC Spain. They spent a lot of time and effort on formulation and chose a simple one.
What do you think the meaning of this combination, should it work, would be, particularly for low-resource settings?
Well, we think it has a role everywhere. I mean, as you know, there's very poor blood pressure control rates, even in high-income countries, and they've been stable or even going down in some places. And making it available in those settings, but definitely we're on a mission to also get approval in low-income countries in parallel and make it available there.
So how's the program running? Can you tell us what status is?
Yeah, it's a very exciting time. We're just getting the results at the moment. In the next couple of weeks, we'll have the full results. It's been a long and hard journey doing a hypertension trial through the pandemic, but I'm sure we've all got stories to tell. So that delayed us by well over a year. But thankfully, we achieved the recruitment targets and are all on track.
So, Anthony, that's very exciting to hear, and I'm sure we're all looking forward to see the results. You mentioned also in the paper about the research needs in the future also for implementing and scaling up. What kind of research you think we need to be doing on top of course, the evidence of effectiveness that we will get from this program?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a need for implementation science type research and all the work that's needed to look at how best to implement a new paradigm into existing models of care and working with existing players. And because they change so much country by country and even within country sometimes, I think we need to shift to that kind of focus. And it is a big challenge in the area more broadly, not just in hypertension. The kinds of different flavors of trials that are needed by regulators and also by reimbursers and also by prescribers. And it tends to, if you have to do those things sequentially, it just delays things by a huge amount of time. I think it would be fantastic if there was some more coordination across all of those so that you can be more efficient and get these treatments to patients quicker.
So who could take on that role?
So I think, obviously, with such a large goal, that needs high-level collaboration and communication and discussion with groups like EMEA and the national reimbursers, and discussion about with the guidelines about some kind of halfway house for clinical trials that might be suitable for all stakeholders. As you know, at the moment, it tends, or certainly historically, you do the trials that the regulators want, and then prescribers say, well, that's interesting, but please can we know what it looks like in my setting or against usual care or in this patient group, etc.
So, Anthony, as we are finishing, this conversation with you, is there anything else that you would like to say that maybe we didn't ask you about the program that you would like to share with the audience?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things that we're really looking forward to see with the results is around the tolerability of these low dose combinations. So as you know, with the hypertension polypill strategy, a big part of the innovation is using these very low doses, and it seems pretty clear that you get most of the efficacy with the low doses. So, but whether you can get acceptable or maybe even lower side effect rates, I think will be really important. It's quite easy to lose sight of the fact a lot of the experts get really interested in the efficacy, but actually it's the side effects or even perceived rates of side effects that determine what happened on the ground.
That's a very good point. And it's part of the pushback sometimes of and fear of adverse effects. So I think that information is going to be very important for the implementation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for sharing the program. And as I said, very keen to see the results. We started this podcast, and as you know, we are covering issues on global cardiovascular research. And we're inviting people that we, like us, we know that they work on this field. But when you try to define what it means, it's kind of an elusive concept. So I'm curious to know from all our interviews, what do they understand? So in your case, what do you understand by global cardiovascular research? Can you share what
Sure.
you say it is?
Well, for me, I'd say it's all about improving health across the world and improving equity and doing research that will inform that in the cardiovascular space across different disciplines and determinants, as well as individual level research.
And I'm sure with this program, you will be doing that. I'm confident of that. So thank you again, Anthony, for sharing the program and for being here in the podcast.
Thanks, Pablo. Great to chat. Take care.
Right, Tom. Well, very glad to have you here as one of the authors on this paper, where you examine the remote management of hypertension and lipids. Now, what was the main reason for you to start all this?
Well, you know, blood pressure and cholesterol are major risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And unfortunately, nowhere in the world have we been very successful at controlling that. In the U.S., probably in the middle of the road of high-income countries, we only control blood pressure at rates of about 50 to 60%. And in lipids, it's much lower, in the 20 to 30%. And what was most shocking to us is in the U.S., those rates are even getting lower. So for the first time ever in the United States, we've seen declines in rates of control of blood pressure and cholesterol. So we're trying to understand why. And I think, and secondly, there is great disparities in access to care. And we wanted to see if we could set up a program that not only dealt with these risk factors and improved upon control, but also did it in a way that didn't increase inequities or disparities in care among different racial or ethnic groups in our area.
So in order to test that out, how did you approach this in your research?
Yeah, so we have access to nearly, you know, 2 million patients that are cared for in the Mass General Brigham system. And we recognized through that data, we could look at and determine people that have had blood pressure or cholesterol measurements, who have potentially either cardiovascular disease established or risk factors for it, or abnormalities, particularly in the blood pressure and cholesterol, and identify those people who are poorly controlled. So what we did is initially identify through our electronic health record all those patients who were in poor control, had a measurement at least within the last year, who were having a primary care physician in our system, and were above the thresholds for appropriate targets for blood pressure or cholesterol based on either their other sets of risk factors, either primary or secondary prevention per se, and engaged them. The plan is taking actually from work that we've done before in low and middle income countries where there has been task sharing, to see if we can improve a remote care plan that engage navigators, or essentially college graduates, nurses, and pharmacists to manage the program, and without making patients having to come into the hospital or to the clinic for their care.
And this information that these navigators then took from the files was translated in recommendations. How were they contributed?
Yeah. Once we identify patients who are potentially eligible based on measurements of blood pressure, cholesterol, we then do a further screening to make sure that those numbers are accurate with sort of a history of their labs and their medicines. We then reach out to the primary care physician, say, is this a patient that you think would be reasonable to participate in a remote only program? So physicians may say, no, I don't think this patient is eligible because they are in hospice or they have a mental health condition that suggests that they may not be able to participate. or that they wanted to manage them in their office in person. After that, we then reach out to patients and we confirm that they are still in care in our hospital system and that they were willing to participate in our system, and that, you know, and letting them know that their physician had agreed for them to participate with us. And if they agreed to participate, send them a blood pressure cuff where we're allowed to get measurements. We use two different types of blood pressure cuffs, one which is Bluetooth enabled, Omron primarily, that allows them to set up an application on their phone and get that data transferred ultimately to us. Or a blood pressure cuff that gets as a cellular chip in it, and the data comes directly to us without them having to develop an application. If they're in the lipid program, if they didn't have a lipid value within 1 year, we would have them go to a lab. They didn't have to come to the hospital, wherever's closest or convenient to them. If after all that they remained eligible and willing to participate, then we created a software system for the navigators that would take in and confirm all the information from electronic health record, and then start to take information about the drugs that they're actually currently taking, the allergies that they have, anything else that may be a roadblock or challenge for them to participate in the program. And if that was cleared, then they began participation in the program.
Did the data program include an educational component for patients?
Yeah, so the patients were all given an educational component, and there were some that chose that they only wanted that and they still wanted to participate, you know, by live in-person visits with their physician, versus they got the educational component, which told them about lifestyle, diet, exercise, things that would reduce either blood pressure or cholesterol. And patients could be in either or both programs. And then, as I said, the majority of the patients said they wanted to participate fully in the program, with the titrations of their blood pressure or cholesterol medicines being done by the pharmacist with support of the navigator. The navigator would basically get the readings from the last 2 weeks or the last cholesterol measurement. We'd set up an algorithm that was approved by a physician, written by a physician, and approved by the state. So to step back, one thing that allows this to happen is Massachusetts allows pharmacists to prescribe off an algorithm of care, a clinical decision algorithm, provided it has been written by the physicians and approved by the state. So they were writing off an algorithm of care for blood pressure and cholesterol that had been written by physicians in our group and approved at the state level.
You had a fairly large population, but as you said, it was also diverse. It's even in the title, I believe. Now, it looks the program worked. Did it work equally well for various population subsegments?
Yeah, so it's just the breakdown. I actually enrolled what the population numbers were in the state of Massachusetts, which is about 70% white, 11% black, and 10% Hispanic. And then there's actually a large number of people that cited they were part of one of those groups, plus others, so Native American, et cetera. And yes, so we did get we looked at the overall reductions, and then we looked by each of those groups, and we did find equal success in all the groups tested, and both male, female, and by Hispanic, African American, or black, and any of the other Native American groups. Some of those are smaller numbers, but in all the larger groups, we found equal success in the program.
And at entry, because there was a selection based on eligibility judged by primary care physicians and so on, was there a difference between these groups in rate of entry?
No, again, we were fortunate that the number of people found eligible fit the demographics of the community, and the response rate was about 90% of people that we were able to reach. Now, the interesting thing is that I think one of the challenges of our program is that it's difficult to reach people to get them to respond to an email or a letter or a phone call. People are sort of anxious about those things, particularly if it comes from an insurer. We were fortunate that I think we had higher rates than insurance-based programs because we were the hospital reaching them, and there was some greater trust with the hospital than it would be from their insurer.
It's quite interesting to hear. I mean, there are two things you mentioned that, of course, I think you know very well, but I think sometimes there's lack of recognition of that this is still a problem in high-income countries, and you mentioned that, and I really like the idea of lessons learned in low and middle income countries about strategies and how you're implementing that in the US. And I think this is one of the very interesting things of this paper. Because part of our audience is there are researchers working on global cardiovascular research, can you explain a little bit more about the study design and also mention any limitation that you think the study design had?
Yeah, so first of all, this is a study, we'll say it wasn't a randomized trial. So it was part of a quality improvement program initiated by the hospital. But we wanted to have some evaluation of the program in terms of success. And so the first thing, everybody that was eligible for the trial was anybody who had an elevation in their blood pressure or cholesterol who was part of our hospital system, and that both their physician agreed they were able to participate and they openly agreed to participate. And so what we're trying to understand was a control group, is it people who didn't agree to participate or didn't respond to us, is kind of, and so we looked at some of those measures. We also wanted to see, you know, and what we ultimately chose as our control group was people who agreed to the idea that they would receive education as a baseline, but wanted to continue to care with their physicians. People who didn't respond, we weren't sure that they were not responding because they were leaving the healthcare system or for other reasons. So we at least wanted to make sure that people that were engaged with the system and that we knew that we would be able to get their measurements. So in that design, again, we did not randomize, but our control group was a group of people who, we compared the people to themselves, first of all, but then we wanted a control group that just received the education alone, because many people say, well, if we just give education to these people and they continue to get care from the physicians, that should be enough. And what we found actually that it isn't enough. It's not just to give education to a group of people who are poorly controlled. They, in the lipid program, there's some engagement or improvement in their cholesterol in that control group. They received about a 10 milligram per deciliter compared to about 40 or 35 in our group that continued to participate. So there are differences. They got something. The blood pressure education really alone did not provide much of an impact.
So what's next? Is this program now going to be implemented as part of routine care in your state?
Yeah, so it's the scaling is always an issue in these types of programs. And initially, this actually started out with a small group of about 1,000 patients sponsored by a payer who was interested in lipid control. Then the hospital got interested in the blood pressure control because of our success there. And then for patients who are being insured, employees essentially are insured by the hospital. But then ultimately said, we want to expand this to the entire population and we will pay for it. And actually, so they recognize the success of that. Beyond the state, we're in discussion with multiple different groups, not just within the state, but across the country on how they may be able to expand this. Peculiar to the United States that the insurance companies are state by state. And so who ultimately adopts this in the different states may be, and we're looking with both, you know, self-employed like Walmart or different large corporations to universities that want to consider to adopt the program. There will be some restrictions, as I mentioned before, it's state by state. So each state has to have the approval of pharmacists being able to prescribe, you know, under a doctor written protocol. So there are a lot of logistic or legal things. And, you know, the U.S. is messy in its healthcare, which is why I think in some ways this is much better in a lot of low-income countries we're working in, while we're expanding it there.
So in terms of research, did you do any economic evaluation or qualitative process evaluation? And if not, do you think that would have been useful?
No, we actually are in the process of a cost-effective analysis of the program. Right now, I mean, there's a lot of cost to input this program, you know, hiring the navigators, which is not part of the healthcare, having the pharmacists run this, designing the software, you know, program to do that. Although those wouldn't be costs necessarily in other places, because now we can adopt that freely. There's sort of sunk costs, but we were not having the cost of doctor visits and we were reducing hospitalization. So we are doing an economic evaluation of that, of the process. We also did a lot of other quality, you know, measurements, you know, evaluation of the program. We talked about multi-channel communication and engage the patients. Almost all the conversations were by the navigator to the patient by phone. But when you're trying to engage patients to participate, we try to figure out, is it better to send them an SMS, to send them a letter from the hospital stationery, whether to communicate to their email, give them a cold call. So there's a lot of quality sort of evaluation for us to understand what's the best way to get a patient engaged in this program. There's a lot of time spent by the navigators by calling and nobody ever answering the phone. People don't necessarily answer the phone. They don't know who it is. And whether you call the landline, should you call cell phones, all kinds of things that we're learning. And then where are people more, you know, some of the younger population were more willing to respond to SMS messaging. Our senior population, which is most of this population, mean age in this population was 65, a little bit more challenging. So we think that there's some things that we're trying to study in terms of if we can determine who's good for this program. Some people need to go to the office and see the doctor, who might be willing to participate in this remote synchronous and asynchronous communication. So a lot of the qualitative stuff that we're unpacking right now and trying to understand why were we successful the ones we were, why do people drop out of the program, why did the education only fail, or, you know, is there something we could supplement somewhere in between?
Yeah, it seems like it's exactly one of those studies that would be very impactful, and you will see the effect immediately, which is greater and within the scope of the papers we want to discuss. I'm curious about the process of conducting this research. It seems like a massive study. Was it very hard? I mean, did you find it more difficult than you expected or easier than you expected? What were the key, I would say, barriers in terms of conducting the research? How was the experience?
Well, I think there's a couple different things that I alluded to a little bit. One of the challenges is actually engaging patients to participate. You know, how do you reach a patient? You know, normally when you're engaging people in a trial, a clinical trial, you've met them in their, because they've been diagnosed with the heart attack in the hospital, and then you engage them when they're there. Or you ask physicians when you have a patient to come in, would you participate in this trial? It's asking people in their homes to participate, not in the healthcare system, to participate in a trial was a little more challenging to reach them. So, I mean, once we actually got them to answer the phone, we had about a 90-95% participation rate. So should we enroll them in the office as opposed to engaging them? But our whole idea was that we're trying to unclutter the office. And this is particularly the motivation from low and middle income countries is that, you know, South Africa, there's 3-hour wait times to see the physician. We want to say, what care can we deliver in the home without in the clinic? So I think that was one challenge, certainly, was engaging the patients to participate initially, to get them to agree. Once they're in, then we were able to manage phone calls. They would say, yes, I trust you. You can call me in 2 weeks from now and I'll answer the phone. Sometimes they didn't, but we were still more likely then. The second part was, the challenge is in writing the algorithm and making sure that we were true to the guidelines and that we were and bringing in all the information from the electronic health record and or the patient to make sure we had the right information. Our goal is right now, and we talk about, you know, AI and the other things, all the data we can get. For us, it was actually sifting out all the data we didn't need. The electronic health records have tons of information that is not actionable. So what was the actionable information we need to make a treatment decision that a navigator, college graduate can be taught, you know, so we really needed to know what their blood pressures were. We needed to know any allergies they had. We needed to know most recent labs, if we're changing something with the electrolytes with some of the medicines, and we need to know how to engage them and then have an algorithm. If they couldn't take one medicine, what would be the next one we would choose? Some things are a little bit different. If you have a remote population, and one of the things we did was we actually, in the blood pressure, we go to calcium channel blocker first rather than a diuretic or an ACE inhibitor, because that would require less initial monitoring. If we got them under blood control with that, then we didn't have to get a blood test from them. It was safer. So we made some of those changes. And then how we finessed which statin to use and how to escalate, you know, were some of the challenges in the algorithm, I think, was sort of the second part of the challenge. And then third was making sure that everybody was comfortable with this on our own side. We were very risk averse initially. We wanted to make sure that the navigator could, if they had a question, they bumped it up to the pharmacist. The pharmacist had a question, they bumped it up maybe to a nurse practitioner or to a cardiology fellow or one of us, an attending cardiologist in our hospital. You know, to always ask questions and bump it up and always be sure that it was necessary. And one of the things we do, and that's some of the continuous process learning, what were some of the questions that are always being asked? Can we change the algorithm so we didn't have that question all the time and make it easier? And I think those are some of the challenges, but also I think one of the more interesting parts of how to design that program.
I'm sure very insightful comments, Tom, and I'm sure it would be useful for many of our audience or interested in doing similar research. So as we are finishing, we like to ask the same questions to all our interviewees. We are all passionate about global cardiovascular research, although we might not agree exactly what that means. So I would like to hear from you, and if you can share, what do you mean for you, global cardiovascular research?
Well, I think, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of different definitions, but for certainly that it is dealing with improving the health of vulnerable populations anywhere in the world. And so that's why, you know, we were trying to make sure that we were reaching a diverse population in certain parts of the Boston area and who may not have access to care. And we are trying to address that issue and improving the access to care. I think, you know, the second part of cardiovascular health is it includes multiple different disciplines. So it's certainly part of a public health, I think, approach, but it can include changes in, you know, understanding of basic science, their understanding, say, for the infectious disease people, you know, new ideas about MDR-TB and multi-drug resistant tuberculosis and cardiovascular disease. It may not be always new drugs, but how do we deliver those new drugs? And that's where I think a lot of global health is in this implementation space where we are, which relies on different disciplines of epidemiology, basic science, the biology, the physiology, but then how cultures work, how communication with people work. Can the health sector be changed in one way or another? The task sharing sort of pieces that we bring into it. And for me, my global health research is bouncing back and forth ideas. I brought the idea of task sharing to this idea in Boston. I'm bringing it back now to two trials that we have in Argentina and South Africa, where we are implementing this blood pressure cuff remote care, but doing it with community health workers and nurses. No physicians are involved in that. So I think for me, cardiovascular health, again, is working with vulnerable populations anywhere and taking knowledge gained from one particular area and perhaps applying it into another area and see if it still works there. We have to understand the differences in the different regions, culture, access to funds, healthcare system infrastructure, and see if we can deliver the basic things like drugs or diagnostics and make them work in those populations.
Clearly passionate about it, Tom, and clearly a paper, a good example of many of the things you said. And I really like the idea of how you learn things from low-income countries bringing to the US and also now expanding to other regions. We'll be keen to hear more about those studies, I'm sure, in the podcast. But thank you again, Tom, for sharing the findings of your paper and your reflections. And thank you for being in the podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you, Aaron.
You're also editor of Global Heart. So I think what we talked with Rick, I don't think there is a space to discuss these kind of papers, and hopefully we can bring interesting papers to the podcast.
Well, I think it's a great idea, and I appreciate you guys doing this. Take care then.
Bye, Tom.
Bye-bye. Bye.